You know, there's a reason for cautionary tales.
Then why don't more people heed their warnings?
I don't know. But after they hear my new show, they will think twice.
Oh yeah? About what?
Eating Tide Pods, playing with Ouija boards, talking to Karens, you name it. If you should heed caution, we're talking about it.
Check out Harper's brand new podcast, Cautionary Tales with Harper. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you download podcasts.
And be sure to press subscribe and give us a review.
Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Subscribe wherever you download podcasts today.
Hope everybody is doing their best right now as we're going through this crazy time in our world. I'm Tony Bruschi, host of Real Ghost Stories Online. Wanted to invite you and let you know about our other brand new podcast that we just launched, Help Kill the Time For You. It's called The Dark Side of Wikipedia. It's about true crime and dark history. We dive into some of the strangest, most disturbed minds and experiences from our history and examine their story, their Wikipedia entry, and then discuss the cases, the individuals, and the psychology of the events as we go through each and every story. Some of our first episodes include Ed Gein, the BTK killer, the New London school explosion, Amityville murders, Richard Speck, Amelia Dyer, the General Slocum disaster, Jeffrey Dahmer, and more. New episodes every single week. Check out Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search it. Subscribe wherever you download podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and more. It's available now with new episodes every single week. Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search and subscribe today and stay safe out there. Today on Real Ghost Stories Online, we're back with Laura DiDio. In its entirety, you're going to hear the entire second half of the conversation I had with her about one of the most haunting and fascinating cases, in my opinion, in our lifetimes. The Amityville Horror, like you've never heard it before, today on Real Ghost Stories Online.
Welcome to Real Ghost Stories Online. Call in your real ghost story now at 855-853-4802 or write in at realghoststoriesonline.com. You are about to enter the world of the unknown and quite possibly the undead. This is Real Ghost Stories Online.
That it is, and we want to hear your real ghost stories. If you got one, call it in. You can do it anonymously or with your name, whatever you want. 855-853-4802 is our phone number, or you can write in at realghoststoriesonline.com, a form right there to fill out and send us your ghost story. We'd absolutely love to hear it. Today's episode of the program, a little bit different than normal. We'll be talking with Laura DiDio. She was one of the main reporters on the Amityville Horror case. This is our second half of the conversation in its entirety, a full hour all about Amityville. If you are enjoying our program, we do this thing year round. I know a lot of folks just start to tune in October, and so many folks find us for the first time in October. Welcome to the show. And if you're enjoying it, please consider supporting it, being an extra podcast person. An EPP is what we call it. Go to ghostpodcast.com. And all you got to do there is sign up. $5 a month gets you access to all of our episodes in their entirety. You get advanced episodes of the show and you get EPP bonus episodes. Brand new ones every single week for you. Plus our entire archive there of them. 300 some for you to binge away on at your leisure. If you want ghost stories, this is the place for you to be. You can also sign up through Patreon if you like Patreon. Patreon.com/realghoststories is where you will find our page there. Again, $5 a month, or you can do the annual membership on either location, and you get 1 month free when you do the yearly thing. So let's get into our interview and pick up our conversation where we left it off yesterday with Laura DiDio and the Amityville Horror. Laura, take us back to what was going on with the Lutzes They had left their home in fear, not knowing what the hell was going on, and they are reaching out for help and not knowing what the hell to do. What was it like?
The Lutzes started inviting people to go into the house that night. The folks at Channel 5 invited some of the another reporter from WNEW Radio, which was our affiliate radio station.
Sure.
The Warrens invited a couple of people. So all of a sudden, instead of it just being the Warrens and Channel 5, you know, we had a cast of about 20 people.
Yeah.
Which was not necessarily conducive to a great seance.
Sure. It becomes almost a tour than it does a seance at that point.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember showing up that night at the house, and it was lit up. All the floors were lit up, and Alex Tanaus, who was... he was part of a psychic New York Institute for Psychic Research in Manhattan. He was he looked like almost like a vampire. I didn't know who he was, and he appeared at one of the side windows there. I almost jumped off the doorstep because he had, you know, hawk-like nose, dark circles under his eyes. I was just so startled.
And in that setting, yeah, it just adds to the mysteriousness.
I had no idea that all of these extra people were going to show up.
Sure.
You know, the other thing that happened was that there was a switch on of reporters. By the way, at Channel 5, the irony about the Amityville coverage on Channel 5, the only ones who were excited about doing this were myself and Mark Monsky. Steve Bauman was not excited about doing this story because he was a serious reporter doing a ghost story, quote unquote, you know, could wreck his reputation. Oh, and by the way, what happened was he suddenly took off for a vacation in one, you know, in Bermuda in mid-afternoon. I didn't know this. Marvin Scott was pressed into service, much to his chagrin, because he and his wife had tickets to go out for months to go to a Broadway show that they had, you know, was sold out for months with friends. Okay, so he wasn't happy. Nobody wanted this. So, you know.
Turns out to be one of the most infamous stories in the history of ghost stories.
Nobody knew
wanted it.
It'd be this big.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you're, as you know, when you're in the news business,
you have no idea. Yep.
So if you're going from one thing to another, after a while, it's especially in New York, it's just another murder, it's just another robbery, it's just another plane crash. That's the way you think about it. It's very pedestrian. So Marvin, actually, when I happened to call the station that afternoon at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, asking for Steve Bauman, they said he wasn't around. He had gone on vacation. I said, what do you mean? And at that point, Marvin had grabbed the phone and said, hey, I've just been assigned this story. Tell me everything about it. I know nothing about it. And he was pretty ticked off, you know, because his wife was ready to divorce him all the late nights. And now you're basically cutting out on, we've had these tickets that it took us months to get. And I've been wanting to go to this Broadway show for months. It's been sold out, and now you're canceling on us.
To go to a haunted house.
So,
yeah.
I know, for a haunted house.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was not that big a story.
Sure.
Again. So when we, you know, we got there, and, you know, more and more people were showing up. Mm-hmm. So it was quite, it was quite the thing. And then what happened, unfortunately, when we did the seance itself, after the seance and we had all of these psychics there that Lorraine had invited, we had one of the psychics ran out of the room, screaming, saying, it's in the second floor bedroom. Somebody else ran out and got sick on the front lawn. I was sitting in between Marvin Scott and Mike Linder, and all of a sudden, at one point, Marvin said to me, "Hey, I just felt a chill." And then 5 minutes later, Mike Linder said to me, "Hey, I just felt a chill." Now, in the ensuing years and decades since, when Marvin has talked about it, he says, "Yeah, at one point during the seance, I felt a little chill." I can tell you that night when Marvin felt the chill, he didn't say, "Yeah, I felt a little chill." He says, "Hey, I just felt a chill."
Yeah.
And Marvin has always said he did not, he's felt more afraid watching the movie when the Amityville Horror came out, more afraid with all the kids throwing popcorn and smoking pot in the theater. But one of the things that happened that night of March 6th when we got there that really struck me, and everybody admitted this, was that our cameraman, Steve Petropoulos, he was about 40, he was slim, and in those days, you had a three-man film crew. Cameraman, sound guy, and the lighting guy. And the equipment was much bigger and heavier in those days. So the cameraman, those guys had to be in shape. Steve Petropoulos was based in New Jersey. And again, it wasn't a huge story, and he wasn't one of our regular staff camera guys. He was one of our regular, like, fourth or fifth guys, so he was a regular stringer for us.
Mm-hmm.
So the camera guys, the film crew arrived at about 10 o'clock, and they... Steve Petropoulos started to walk up the stairs to the second floor. That was where everybody, started. There was one spot at the second floor landing where people felt things. But Steve walked up. Steve and I were chatting at the foot of the stairs, and I was introducing him to the different psychics. So Steve says, "I'm going to take a look around." And he started to walk up the stairs, and he got five steps up, and he said to myself and Alberta Riley, she was one of the other psychics that Ed and Lorraine Warren had invited, he turns around and he says, "There's a room on the second floor, the second door on the right," he says, "and it's filled with mirrors." And he said to me, "I don't know how I know that." Now, I had been in the house before, the week before. That was the master bedroom. That was the DeFeo's bed, Louise and Ronald DeFeo Sr.'s bedroom, where they had been shot. The wall behind their bed had those 12x12 mirrored tiles,
mm-hmm.
like in Las Vegas.
Sure.
So I'm like, okay. And again, that really hadn't been in any of the papers, so I don't know how he would know that.
Yeah.
So he then continued up the stairs, and before he reached the landing, just when he gets almost to the top landing, he doubled over in pain, and his face, that, he was, it got red, and then the blood drained out of his face, and he stumbled down the stairs, and we, you know, he's clutching his chest, and he said that he's gasping, and he said his heart started to palpitate wildly as though he was having a heart attack, and he doesn't have any history of heart trouble.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we get him some water, and he sat there and calmed down, and it passed. And then no sooner does Steve Petropoulos, our cameraman, recover, than Mary Pascarella, who's another one of the psychics that who's the Warrens had invited, she's taken ill, and she feels nauseous and dizzy. So they take her upstairs so she can lie down and rest. So at that point, it's now about 10:45, and we started to gather around the dining room table and to begin the seance. And we've basically got a cross and candles.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of other people, I think, that the Lutzes, that George Lutz had invited. And that was, they were from Duke University or... that school of parapsychology. And they were sort of skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And for a little, there was some contretemps going on between them and Ed Warren. And Ed basically said to them that those two that he really didn't want them present because they were challenging the house. And so there was that, you know, there was that going around. But
sure.
We had to hold up the seance for a little bit. This was kind of funny because we had to get the camera, the right camera angles and lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Ed Warren, the candles and the crucifix are there to serve as irritants to antagonize the demonic force. So, again, Ed, in this instance, as Lorraine went into the trance, the light trance state acts as the guide.
Mm-hmm.
So, at first, Lorraine got nothing except a solid, dark mass. And she was speaking slowly. And what it looks like is she appeared, you know, normal, but it looks like she was straining as if she's trying to see a picture unfold on a TV screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And she said, you know, certain people give this the force in the house energy, and she said that George Lutz was one of them. She also said that she saw an older clergyman in a black garb and who uses old rituals, and she said that man would be the one who would be able to rid the house of the force, but it would take him 3 occasions to do so. And according to Lorraine, George Lutz was spiritually warned to leave the house before personal tragedy could strike he and the rest of his family. And she said that the force would need to be expelled before other people could live in the house in peace. So, then shortly after that, Alberta Riley was speaking at the other end of the table, and that's when she started shouting, "It's upstairs in the bedroom." And then she also was gasping for air and said she had heart palpitations. And then Mary Pascarella said that there was a subtle but pervasive element in the house which affected a tall, thin man who lived there in the late 1800s. And at that point, Ed Warren felt that the psychics extended themselves enough, and he halted the seance. And then we had somebody else bolt out of their seat and stumble out of the room and vomit, you know?
Yeah.
So by midnight, after the seance had ended, people basically dispersed into different groups and exploring, you know, other regions of the house. And Marvin said to me, we were upstairs, and he says, I don't think we have it. You know, because Marvin knew, as I knew, when, you know, for television, what you're looking for is something akin to poltergeist.
Sure.
And as I've always said, just because you've got a camera crew there doesn't mean that ghosts, spirits, demonic forces are going, you know, they're not card-carrying members of AFTRA.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to show up and perform on command. You know, just because we're there for 2 or 3 hours.
Sure.
You know, Lorraine also thought, by the way, at the time, that the negative force that was at the Amityville house was able to operate through inanimate objects. Mm-hmm. And she did point out the figure of the ceramic lion and pictures on the wall. So we did go upstairs into the second floor bedroom. And the sewing room, and Marvin did try and conduct another mini seance with Lorraine in the sewing room, because Lorraine felt that the sewing room was the source of a lot of evil.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if nothing's going to happen, what it looks like for the television cameras is that you're sitting around talking in a dimly lit room.
Sure.
You know.
This is the night where the ghost boy photo comes up, correct?
At some point, yes.
Okay.
I mean, because, again, the Warrens had that fellow that they worked with, Paul Bartz,
mm-hmm.
who was in a plaid shirt. And the ghost boy photo, there's, you know, the boy in the photo, whoever that was also in a plaid shirt.
Because there's some argument, correct, that it may have just been him on his knees or something, kind of looking over and looking up, and then the light catching his eye. And there's also the argument that it could be one of the DeFeo children.
And there's been a lot of speculation about who or what it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have no idea. I can't vouch for it being true. I can't vouch for it being fake, mm-hmm. because I wasn't there when the picture was developed.
Sure.
I'm as mystified as anybody else. It didn't look like any of the DeFeo kids to me. I mean, Mark or John, that would have to be who it was. It clearly was not Ronnie Jr.
Sure.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, it looks like Paul Bartz. I didn't really think it looked like Paul Bartz either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything. Who knows? You know, to me, it's a big question mark. And if it was a fake, who faked it?
Yeah.
So, that's, you know, who I don't know who developed the pictures.
Yeah.
I heard third, fourth, fifth hand that now nobody's contacted Paul Bartz. I don't know where he is. But I heard third, fourth, or fifth hand a long time ago that somebody allegedly called Paul Bartz and asked him if he developed it. And was it fake? And he said, you know, I'm not saying anything. So I don't know. But, and nobody knows where Paul Bartz is.
Sure.
I've never seen to him since then.
This adds to the more mystery around the whole case.
A lot. As you know, the best time to affirm the validity and do your fact-checking and track something down is in the immediate aftermath of an incident. Whether you're, trying to find out about a traffic incident, a robbery, a murder, or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
It's been, 1976 is, you're going back 43 years.
Yeah.
Many of the principals have passed on, including, George and Kathy Lutz, and of course, sadly, Lorraine Warren passed away just a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the trail gets cold.
Sure.
In talking to, of course, Danny Lutz, Christopher, and his brother Christopher Quarantino, they still to this day are very definitive in saying that these things happened to them.
Yeah. And that's an interesting, almost a new chapter to the story that we've seen in recent years with the documentary My Amityville Horror and Danny speaking about his truth and what he believes happened to him in that house. And Christopher also coming out now and speaking more than he had in the past. Everything with allegations, many allegations against George. George obviously not around anymore to defend himself. But there's, of course, allegations out there for our listeners who don't know of abuse. There's allegations of George being involved with occult practices or transcendental meditation and many other things as well. What was your knowledge of any of that stuff at the time when you were the reporter working on this case? I mean, I'm guessing you probably didn't know anything about the allegations of abuse, but as far as George being involved in anything occult or anything of that nature?
Well, I think what George always said to me was that at the time was that, he was sort of a non-practicing Methodist.
Yeah.
And when this happened to him, Kathy was brought up as a devout Irish Catholic. George was sort of a non-practicing Methodist. And when this happened to him, he told me he began to research everything he could, taking a crash course in the occult.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he had a lot of books on everything from Padre Pio, the very famous, priest who was, a mystic.
Sure.
Who famously had the stigmata, Christ's wounds from the cross.
Yeah.
To the Fatima apparitions, he had books there on, ghostly apparitions and hauntings, etc. As for Danny had said that, and Christopher have both told me that George would be practicing occult rituals out in the garage and things like this and telekinesis. And, to that, I would say, you and I could get bell, book, and candle.
Sure.
Anybody could try and practice that. That doesn't mean we're going to be successful.
Sure.
So I think that might be, rather far-fetched. I could try and do a spell and incantation, but this is not, charmed.
Yeah, sure.
What can you say? As for abuse, I mean, you have to put this into context. Danny was six when his parents got divorced. Christopher would have been four. And Missy would have been, what, two?
Yeah.
So a divorce, especially going back to the mid-70s, divorce is traumatic in any event for kids.
Sure.
Danny was a very, very strong-willed little boy, and he was very, very close to his mother. And Christopher was a much gentler personality.
Mm-hmm.
Danny wasn't going to like any stepfather that came in. So if you see those, Danny is a very intense person. What you see in those posters with those ice blue eyes is what you get.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if you saw My Amityville Horror, Danny lays it on the line.
He does, yeah.
He makes no bones about the fact that he did not like George, and he was not going to back down. And so George came in, and he was the stepfather, and George did say that the house worked on his personality. And he said that he became like a drill sergeant, ordering the kids around. So in the context of today, that might be considered a form of abuse. Do I think that he was beating the kids with belts and things like that? You know, holding their feet to the fire? No. But, and certainly he treated the girl, Missy, differently from the boys. So there's no doubt that he clashed with Danny big
sure.
time.
Sure.
And Danny reciprocated that. Christopher, you know, was not going to clash as openly with him. But yeah, I mean, he was going to be a disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, in recent years, speaking out more and more about what went on, and in some words or less, he's alluded to there being much more to the story than the public is even aware of, or that's been told yet. And obviously, he was, you know, one of the few people that are still around that were in the house when these things were going on. But that allusion to there's more that no one knows about yet, and I'm not quoting directly, but just roughly what he said, that he wants to share when the time is right, essentially. Do you have any sense as to what he's referring to when he makes the claims like that or makes statements like that?
Well, I only know what they've said publicly. Yeah. and what they've said to privately to, you know, myself and, you know,
sure,
and the Warrens over the years. You know, I mean, certainly they saw some horrifying things. I mean, Danny had said, and he said it in My Amityville Horror, mm-hmm. he and his mother were sitting in the kitchen, and they felt a figure come into the kitchen. He felt something go right through him almost.
Yeah.
He also said he and Christopher were in the upstairs third floor bedroom that belonged to Ronnie DeFeo Jr.
Mm-hmm.
They saw that sort of black figure,
mm-hmm.
you know, come into their room. That would be rather terrifying.
Sure.
You know, and of course, I guess they found some of the stash of Ronnie DeFeo's drugs or,
oh, well,
you know, paraphernalia.
Yeah.
In the closet there.
Sure.
and there was the incident of the beds levitating.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I'm not sure. But all of those things were, you know, that would be enough to terrify me.
Those are pretty big in themselves. I'm very fascinated.
I mean,
yeah. I've been trying to...
You know, and I've heard allusions to the fact that those ceramic lions supposedly moved, a la, you know, Stephen King's The Shining.
Yeah.
So there have been any number of things mm-hmm. over the years. But again, the only one who has steadfastly stayed out of the public eye and doesn't talk at all is Missy. And she was the one who had the story about, you know, Jody, the pig. Now, Missy, of course, was only 5 years old. She had not yet reached the age of reason, which is generally considered to be 7.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, when we did Miamityville Horror, Eric Walter put that all together, and I was a producer on that, and mm-hmm. I interviewed Jenny. We had Eric Walter got a top, you know, two top-notch psychologists to talk to Danny, and they came away, you know, convinced that, you know, Danny was not lying.
Yeah.
You know, the way the psychologist put it was that, you know, he believes all of this. Now, I don't think that Danny is delusional.
No.
And the other thing is, Danny, you know, Danny was 9 when this happened. A lot of people say he was 10, but he was 9. And the reason I take pains to point this out is that there's a big difference developmentally from 9 to 10.
Sure.
It's not like being 30 or 31. So that's a lot for him, you know, to go through.
Yeah.
And certainly, I think... His wife, by the way, when Danny got married and had 2 kids, his wife didn't even know that he was the quote unquote kid from the Amityville Horror until she went to a video store one night to rent a video. And she was renting the Amityville Horror, and she saw his name on the back of it, and she said, "Is that you?"
What a way to find out.
Exactly. And I think in a lot of ways, when he did Danny left home in his teens, and they were living in, after the Lutzes, George and Kathy, got divorced, Danny left Arizona and he came back to New York. So he separated himself from that. He basically locked that whole experience away. And it wasn't until he did the Miamityville Horror documentary,
mm-hmm.
going back to 2011, you know, when we were filming that, that he unlocked the door to that. And I think that let it all out again.
You have to wonder sometimes with something like this, you know, just as extreme of a case that this was, of what they went through. Sometimes being able to talk about these things openly and publicly is therapeutic, but you have to wonder, in this case, was it really, or did it just stir everything back up to plague him even more than before? But that's a question, obviously, only he can answer.
I think it's cathartic for both Danny and Chris.
Yeah.
That was something that they went through. I mean, especially coming on the heels of, you know, their parents' divorce. And then also imagine having to go to school and face all of your peers.
Sure.
On that. And then the movie comes out and the book comes out. And the kids were aware of it. There's no way to shield them from it. But imagine if that happened today.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the mid-70s, the Lutzes could go underground and basically hide a bit in plain sight. Today, that would not be possible.
No.
I mean, you know, they could, you know, today they'd have to go off the grid entirely.
Their furniture, everything, they left the house. What about their possessions? Did they ever go back and get anything, or what happened with all of that when they left?
What happened was they did ask the Warrens if they could get a couple of things for them, from them, mm-hmm. from the house for them. But other than that, most of the stuff supposedly they let the bank take. Okay. I did go back into the house. I had their house keys. I went into the house. I went back in by myself a week or two after the seance with my dog. And I had an experience there. I just wanted to go back in mm-hmm. and see what would happen. It was in the middle of a Saturday afternoon. I went in with my dog Fritz, who was a German, both parents were purebred. He was a German Shepherd Labrador Retriever. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned the breed because, as you know, a lot of Labradors and Golden Retrievers are empathetic in terms of being able to predict when somebody's going to have a heart attack or an epileptic seizure or a diabetic seizure.
Yep.
I have no such idea if Fritz never predicted anything like that, but he was a very empathetic dog, and as a shepherd, he was very protective. So I was walking around I wasn't supposed to be in the house, technically, but I still had their house keys. And I just wanted to see what would happen, because I was never bothered by anything in the house when I was there. Never felt a chill, never had heart palpitations, never felt physically ill. So I was walking around the house on the bottom floor, and Fritz was in the foyer. And all of a sudden I heard the dog growling. So I came back out, and he's standing at the bottom of the stair landing, staring up at something again on that second floor landing, right at the spot where everybody got sick or had a bad feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And all the hackles were up from his neck to his to all the way down his back. And he's just staring, fixed stare, teeth bared, ears back, looking at something.
Yeah.
And I don't see anything, and I can't hear anything. There's nobody there, and I started up the stairs. It was really creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, this is perhaps not a good idea. Because he was looking at something, like he could see something, and I couldn't.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, nobody told my dog that six people were murdered in this house. Nobody told my dog that there could be a demonic force here.
Mm-hmm.
I had never seen my dog act like this before. This was not a spooky puppy, and it was not an old dog. This was a dog who was 4 years old in the prime of his life, who, you know, was a New York dog, was used to the sights and sounds of the city, etc. I had never seen him act that way before or since. But he clearly saw or sensed something that I didn't.
And sometimes that's that's the best proof you have right there, is how the animals react to
exactly
a situation.
So I said, time to leave. Okay, so call me a chicken, but between that and what happened with Steve Petropoulos, mm-hmm. the cameraman.
Sure.
that was, you know, to me, that's the best evidence. And then fast forwarding to, you know, 2006, sitting here in my office and having the urge to talk to Lorraine Warren.
Yeah.
Out of blue, and then finding out that the very moment I got that urge and was on the phone with Lorraine Warren for 2 hours, and very moment we were talking, that George Lutz, you know,
yeah,
was having a heart attack and dying.
That is so, yeah, that's very bizarre. Do you think there's anything about this case yet that we don't know? That we've yet to discover about it or hear about in any sort of major sense, other than just a perspective here and there, maybe from one of the kids, you know, recounting some of the occurrences that went on in the house.
I suppose there's always something. Okay, I think it involves. Actually, the live human behavior, mm-hmm. really. Ultimately, it's a lot of the story of human greed and human kindness. With Lorraine's passing in the last 2.5 weeks, it gave me time to reflect on this. I mean, and somebody who was known for her psychic abilities, I think what often gets overlooked here is what she and Ed most wanted to do was actually help people. So that was at the very beginning of this. I mean, one of the things people don't realize is that over the years, like the following year after this, when the Lutzes moved to California, she and Ed were out there, and Ed spent a lot of time talking to Danny and Chris, just walking on the beach, just talking to those kids, trying to help them out, mm-hmm. and sort of being a sort of really big brother uncle type,
sure.
to them. And When we went to film at Lorraine's house, and Danny was with us, Danny hadn't seen Lorraine for years. And Lorraine was, "Danny, how are you doing? Are you okay?" And she asked him how, you know, George had treated him. She was very dismayed when Danny was saying to her that, you know, he didn't have a good relationship with George. Mm-hmm. And Danny was very solicitous of Lorraine. You know, so there's that. She was very concerned, you know, both Ed and Lorraine were very concerned about the living. I mean, that's a wonderful testament.
Sure.
And I started to tell you, here's an interesting thing that happened. Back in 2006, May 5th, 2006, I was sitting here in my home office, and I'm working. I was writing a report on high technology, which I do, having nothing to do with Amityville. And all of a sudden, the thought pops into my head, like a little psychic flash. I have to call Lorraine Warren. And I hadn't talked to Lorraine in about a year. And it wasn't one of those things where you think, oh, I haven't talked to so-and-so in a while, I have to give them a call. It was, I have to call Lorraine Warren now. I picked up the phone, I called Lorraine, she answered. I said, "Lorraine, how are you doing?" And we spent the next 2.5 hours on the phone. And of course, we talked a lot about Amityville. And at that point, Ed was at home, and he was incapacitated from a stroke that he had suffered several years before. And he had lost the power of speech. But Lorraine said she could communicate with him. you know, psychically. She always knew what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, later that night, I see a story breaks over the wire that George Lutz had died earlier that day from a sudden heart attack. And he had died of the heart attack while Lorraine and I were talking on the phone out in Las Vegas. So I called Lorraine back the next day. I said, Lorraine, did you see that? I said, and I had told her when I called her, I said, Lorraine, I have this sudden urge to call you. I don't know why. And then I called her back the next day. I said, Lorraine, did you see this? George Lutz died.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and I had this sudden, and yesterday I had this sudden urge to call you. And at the exact time that he was having the heart attack out in Las Vegas.
Wow.
And she said, I'm not surprised. that's what happens. But so something in the ether out there in the universe, I don't consider that a coincidence.
No.
And another funny thing, one of the researchers that worked with Ed and Lorraine, also worked with them, Brian McIntyre, he's now an Eastern Orthodox priest, and he goes by the name of Father Maximos McIntyre. I was coming out of my local supermarket about a mile away, and this fellow comes up to me and he says, you're Laura DiDio. And I said, yes. And he said, he introduces himself, I'm Father Maximos McIntyre. I was Brian McIntyre, and I worked with Ed and Lorraine Warren. He lives right nearby now.
Okay.
What are the chances?
Yeah, not good.
But, I know, but that incident where I was just sitting here at my computer writing a report on high technology, having nothing to do with anything, and the thought just came into my head, I have to call Lorraine Warren.
Yeah. One of those things you can't explain, but they happen. They happen, and they're undeniable when they do.
Yeah, there's a lot of things behind the scenes with a lot of the people who were involved in Amityville. I mean, I think over the years, people have said that no one else has, all the subsequent four or five families who have lived in the house in the 43 years since the Lutzes moved in and out, that there haven't been any other incidents. I don't think that's true.
Well,
you do hear other things.
This is interesting because that is exactly what I've heard, is that nothing else has happened to anyone that's lived there. What leads you to believe that or think that?
Because other people have said things. There was I've seen things online. There are real estate agents who have gone in there, and you see accounts, people see things, you know, you'll see things on forums and things online. There was a fellow who went in, he's a realtor, and he said he went into the house to show it, and he said he just felt really bizarre. He had a there was an open house, and he went in with a coworker, and the coworker said, he and this other woman went in and said, you know, something feels weird. And at the time, he said, this fellow James said he didn't feel anything. He wrote the comments off as angst. And of course, they knew the history of the house. Everybody out on Long Island did.
Sure.
And when they went down to the basement in the cellar where the oil burner is, this other woman named Jane got spooked and she felt something, and they felt the temperature in the room drop, and they felt an eerie feeling and very cold air, and they just felt an eerie feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the middle of summer. And they said it felt like somebody had opened a freezer door, so they just wanted to get out of there. And they said there was a concrete wall and it had a square hole in it. So anyway, the woman wanted to just get the heck out of there, and she got out of the house and said, I'm not going back. And this woman was an agent, and these two people had just met that day. So they, you know, mm-hmm. went off. And then he says, the fellow said, I'm the biggest skeptic there is. And he said, if I was by myself, I would have just thought maybe I had too many Amityville Horror movies in my head. And he says, but, you know, I was there with other people, and we were, you know, having the same feeling. So it legitimized the feelings.
It makes you wonder how many other stories there are inside that house after the Lutzes that they just didn't want to share, or that people didn't want to share for publicity and all that.
Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, and what people will say for the camera and what, the, you know, or publicly mm-hmm. is not the same as what they'll say. And Brian Wilson, one of the subsequent owners of the house, when he had a moving sale, okay, mm-hmm. you had to see, everybody was showing up. The newspapers, you know, that was in August of 2010.
Sure, I remember that.
People, hundreds of people showed up for this moving sale. They had, you know, tape and bodyguards mm-hmm. had to be hired to keep the sale under control. They would only let 20 people at a time enter the house. And of course, a lot of it was, you know, people just wanted to get in and get a look at it. And they wouldn't let people into the basement or the upstairs room.
Yeah.
And then I did call up David and Caroline D'Antonio, who bought the house in 2010. And spoke to them at the time. And my conversation with them, and Mr. D'Antonio has since passed away from cancer, and they were longtime Amityville residents. And they basically said, oh, there's nothing, you know, in this house that's weird. And they didn't really, you know, want to talk about it. They said it was all made up. But, and we had wanted to try and get in for a story that we were doing. And the wife had said to me, Caroline D'Antonio, well, if my husband okays it, we would do it. And I said, you know, we'll be very respectful and, you know, not try and be sensational. So, and the husband got on the phone. So I was on the phone with both of them. And the husband says, everybody says what you're saying and et cetera. And so they were being very nice and polite to me. And at one point as soon as I mentioned Danny's name, mm-hmm. it got very weird. At that point, Mrs. D'Antonio said, Danny Lutz, he's the reason. He and George Lutz, they're the ones that brought the darkness into this house. I'd never let Danny Lutz into this house. He could bring the darkness back in here. I said, okay. So on the one hand, she had said to me, she thought it was, she believed the New York Times article, she referenced a New York Times article that basically said it was all made up.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, at the mention of Danny Lutz's name, she said Danny Lutz and George Lutz were the ones that had brought the darkness into the house.
Very bizarre. Very, very bizarre.
I don't know how Danny Lutz, at the age of 9, a 9-year-old child, could have been responsible for bringing darkness into the house.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
No. So there were a lot of contradictions, and there were a lot of anomalies that occurred in the story, and a lot of things that went on behind the scenes.
And it makes you wonder what else will ever come out about this case and this story. There are, of course, still some family members still alive. Are we going to hear more at some point in time? It seems to be the story that really never quite ends. A big thank you to Laura DiDio for joining us on today's program, sharing all of her insight, one-of-a-kind insight into one of the most fascinating cases, in my opinion, ever. If you like our program, keep us on the air, become an extra podcast person, EPP at ghostpodcast.com or patreon.com/realghoststories. Until next time, for all of us at Real Ghost Stories Online, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.